If this be jest, then it is too bitter for laughter. Nay, it is the last move in a great jeopardy, and for one side or the other it will bring the end of the game. Then he drew Andoril and held it up glittering in the sun. You shall not be sheathed again until the last battle is fought, he said.
It is episode 64 of the Great Company Podcast. My name is Derek. Tonight we are going to continue our book club and wrap up the first book of The Return of the King. Joining me tonight is Dan. How are you, sir?
Doing well.
Anything new down there, old Texas way?
We got a chance at the Austin weekly Lord of the Rings meetup to play the second quest of the limited edition starter.
Okay.
Week. And we played it four player. And it was a blast.
Mm. Cool. Awesome. Also joining me tonight is Matthew. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good. Did you get around to playing the Collector's Edition as well?
I have not played either quest.
Okay.
I've just admired the pretty cards.
They are so pretty. Man, I really like the layout, and I love that they kind of Dan has more of an art background than I do. Like, re-centered the cards so mm-hmm. that, like, the knife guide is a little bit more centered on her face, and I think they did a really nice job with that layout.
Framing, I think, is the word you're looking
framing,
for.
Framing, thank you. Yeah. Composition. Yeah.
The positivity towards the new layout or formatting of the cards is pretty much overwhelming online, but I saw one jerk face who completely hated it and said it's so horrible and disgusting, he hopes it never happens again. I was like,
how dare you change my game?
I know. I was like, bro, it's way better, so get over yourself.
Yeah, the encounter cards, especially to me, some of them mm-hmm. just pop, mm-hmm. where it's the same art that I've seen before, and I see it now, and I just go, holy crap, that looks amazing.
Yeah. It's like HD restoration of an old movie.
That's right.
Yeah, collector's edition, perfect. Yeah. I've been very, very stoked about that product and also the digital game. I got to play... Okay, so a big reason why I haven't played much Lord of the Rings, really in the last year... I've played a few times this year solo, played on Octagon and things like that. But a big reason why I haven't been playing much is just strictly pragmatic. It's just been like square peg, round hole for like at least a year where I've got, you know, maybe a couple hours to myself at a time. And so when I decide I want to play and I look at my big ass card hotel and I think about tearing down a deck and building a new deck and getting everything set up. It's kind of like, I'll throw an Arrested Development reference your way, because apparently people our age, maybe it's still topical, where there's a scene in season 4 where he makes up his mind and he's going to go to Arizona to actually go to the physical University of Arizona, and he flies to Arizona. You'll like this, Matthew. And he gets out of the airport, he feels the heat, and he says, nah, shakes his head and goes back into the airport. It's kind of like that, where I'm just like, nah, I'm good. I don't want to deal with you cars right now. So having like the pre-built decks that were tailor-made by Mr. Caleb Grace in the Collector's Edition, and then the sheer ease of being able to build decks and change decks and just log in and play on the digital game, man, I've been loving it the last week.
Yeah, I had to build it. I started campaign mode for the first time with my local group here, or some of the folks in my local play group, and I had to build a deck for that, and I was just like, I think in my brain, cards don't really exist like past the Heirs of Numenor cycle, maybe maybe the Ringmaker cycle. And so it's like, my cards are not organized in any fashion. But I go to build a deck, and I'm like, God, there's got to be more stuff. And of course there is, but it's really hard to deck build these days. I think that that some sort of, you know, website maybe where cards are listed would be great.
But who? Who could make such a website?
But
seriously,
something like that existed.
It is really difficult, and I agree with you completely. So,
You are missed, Matthew. After all this time, that you could still drop that turd in the punch bowl, it brings joy to my heart. Sir.
That was the original one. I thought, if I do say so myself,
never. Never stop being you. Matthew. Right. Never so stop.
So I played the Oath with my wife like the night we got the box, and even she enjoyed it. You know, we ran out of those little tokens, but I had to go get some more from my core set. But
oh, that's funny.
The self-containedness is awesome, and I'm loving the digital game. We talked a little bit before we started recording about it. So why don't we jump into that before we continue the book club? Sure. What are you guys' kind of initial impressions for the? There's no easy name for it. It's the Lord of the Rings living card game, but it's the digital living card game. So
yeah, I was struggling with that when I was starting the process of adding it to this search site that I have that doesn't exist according to Matthew. Yeah, the one that would be really great if it existed. No, I'm just calling it digital for now because I have
I don't have
another unambiguous thing to call it. But I like it so far. I'm curious to hear your guys' thoughts on it.
I freaking love it. I mean, I think I'm on record several times on the show over the years saying, I've been playing a lot of Hearthstone this week. Man, if only we had a blah, blah, blah for Lord of the Rings. And while there's certainly some rough edges because we're in beta, we call it early access if you want, it's still beta. And there's some things that I don't like about it and some things that will get better as the game develops, especially in terms of card pool. Where we are with it right now, even just not even a week into early access, I've played way more than I have played tabletop. I think that it's a different game, and I'm sure you guys will say the same thing, but it feels very similar to me in terms of the story, like the transitions between locations where you get the narrated story feels just like something you would read out of a pack of cards or on the flavor text of a quest card. And even though all the phases are jumbled together, because you might quest or play a card or attack or defend on any given turn, it still feels like I'm making the same decisions. And then when you get to that next location, for example, and the board fills up with orcs or spiders or some nasty treachery gets played, it's the same, like, oh crap feeling. Like I'm never going to get through this as it is with the tabletop game. And there's some issues, there's some things that I don't like, but the fact that I'm playing it a lot and enjoying it a lot and noticing improvements, and I feel like after a certain point it clicked with me, and a lot of the decisions I was used to making on tabletop transferred over to the digital space. I'm not over the moon necessarily yet,
Your last comment is particularly fascinating to me because I'm also enjoying it, but I find that it is a very different game strategically than the tabletop. I think the fact that the AI chooses who he attacks, for anyone out there that's tried it and is really frustrated thinking it's too hard, I'm going to give one word of advice, and that is defend.
Yeah.
Is your friend. If the game feels too hard, learn to defend.
Or just go to easy mode.
That too. But
hashtag
easy
mode squad.
Yeah, I've only been playing it in normal. I don't really want to see what hard looks like at this point, and I'm not particularly interested in easy either. I want to kind of take the middle of the road and see how I can play it that way. But it's interesting. It feels very different to me, though. Honestly, I hear where you're coming from. There's some similar things. I love that they improved locations. Like, I absolutely love the way locations work in this versus the card game. It actually feels like you're moving from place to place, and there's that sense of dread when you're playing a quest you haven't played before, and you hit the travel button, you're like, oh crap, what's about to happen? Which is really cool. It's weird how, like, the timing is so... It's very asynchronous, where it's like, I do something, and then I don't really know, like... The board state can change very quickly because, you know, you look at Sauron's resources and you realize, oh, he's got a bunch of money. And so even if there's nothing out, even if I've killed everything that's in play, like, you don't really know what's going to happen next. Whereas I feel like the card game, there's kind of more predictability in terms of the board state in the card game.
It's funny because I've heard the opposite on Reddit. I've been trying to stay as active as I can on socials. And so, like, Reddit and Facebook, there's people who have said it's too easy. And part of the reason they say it's too easy is because the AI pattern becomes kind of predictable. And I had, like, a really easy time with Quest 5. I net decked, and I'll shout out the person whose deck I ripped off later when I remember to check who it was. But on that Quest 5, I got my guys kind of beefed up so they could defend. And then the Bilbo ability strips a resource from Sauron. So I kind of hit this rhythm where I set Aragorn or Legolas on defense. The enemy attacks. use Bilbo to steal a resource, which hinders Sauron, and I got into a good rhythm. So I don't know if it is actually predictable or if I just had one really good game. But that's a different issue entirely. One other thing I want to speak to is you talked about the vibe. And I think, like, with the defense thing, it's...
You mean guard? Is that what we're talking about?
No, yeah, guard, sorry. Guard gives me the same vibe as when I'm defending, even though in the tabletop I choose who's attacking my defender. There's still an element of surprise with the shadow cards. And I feel... I guess that's what I mean when I say it's the similar vibe, because even though I don't choose who's attacking my defender in the digital game... there's the randomness of shadow cards and tabletop, so there's still an element of the uncertain in both games, and so maybe that's why it gives me a similar feeling with a lot of these things. What do you think, Matthew?
Well, I pretty much feel like I paid $100 for a physical card expansion.
Why do you
just
say
kidding?
That?
I think it's fun. Okay. So it is a totally different game, and it's taken a big adjustment for me to get used to it, in that you don't always need to fight every enemy that's in front of you, which is hard for me to accept. You can just travel and leave, and they get left behind. I almost never use Fate. You posted on Twitter our little conversation there. Most of them, because my people are doing other things. So I have two decks built. One is probably trash, and then one's just the starter deck. Eowyn is always going to the main little... I don't even know what they're called. Objectives? I never have time to do Fate, because she's the only one who can really do that. Every once in a while, allies can help. So Fate is almost a non-entity in most of my games, unless I happen to get like a really easy turn or something. But I threat out a ton in this game, where I like never do in the tabletop game. I can't get past the third quest. I'm stuck. So with both the deck I've built and the starter deck that just comes with the game itself. So yeah. I can't even imagine what the fifth quest is like. So, and I think I always get to like the end of the third one, but I threat out like the last one. I'm like so close, but I don't know.
I think that's where Fate comes in, is like you might have to give up a turn, but there's usually something that will benefit you to either reduce your threat or just to keep trucking. But yeah, threat's crazy.
Yeah.
Especially
I usually use Gandalf to... Yeah, they are. I usually use Gandalf to ping enemies, because there's always so dang many, but maybe I should use it for something else. But it's definitely fun. It is different. It's not the same game. They are the same in that they share art and the name. The decisions are totally different. The cards are totally different. The abilities are different. I mean, I think I agree with you in the sense that the vibe is there, that the flavor's there. But honestly, even if the Lord of the Rings tabletop game didn't exist, I'd probably still play this. I think it's fun.
Yeah. And I'll be very curious to... go ahead, Dan.
Oh, just... There's obviously some rough edges. I mean, this is early access we're describing, so if I want to get nitpicky, there's some UI, you know, usability, user interface improvements I would make. It's hard to tell what my heroes have attached. It's hard to kind of scan and quickly see the board state. So these are all things that are solvable problems, but it definitely feels to me rough. And there's also a part of me that gets curmudgeonly when I'm playing it, because I basically have to test software all day for a living. So instead of getting paid to do it, I'm essentially paying them to test their software, which is... I hike up my curmudgeon pants when I think about it that way, but it's fun. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I haven't had that many bugs. Every once in a while when I drag a character to like attack something, there's a slight lag. But for the most part, I mean, as far as the, I don't know, performance of it, it seems pretty smooth. I guess I get what you're saying in terms of layout of stuff, but...
You're lucky, then, because I've had it crash on me.
I've never had it crash.
Issues.
I've never had that.
I think you're in the minority on that, honestly, because looking on the Discord, it looks like other people were having some of the issues that I was having.
I have
as
had
well.
The server thing, get the notification once about the server. I closed Steam, restarted, and it was fine. I didn't get it again.
Are you playing on your Mac or your PC?
Yeah, my Mac. And it is the brand new Mac from this year. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
I'm sure that helps. My Mac's a little older, but it's more than up to the task. I mean, I don't really think this game is the kind of thing that requires like insane horsepower.
Yeah.
No.
I would hope not.
Yeah.
The other thing I did, though, is I did turn down some of the graphics stuff, because honestly, I don't need... Derek and I talked about this before we started recording, but like, there's definitely some graphic stuff decision they're making that's very reminiscent of Hearthstone, and I hope they back off some of that stuff, because I don't need it to shake and things to explode to feel like it's epic. It's freaking you know, it's Lord of the Rings, beloved Lord of the Rings characters killing orcs and spiders and trolls and stuff. It's already epic. You don't need to do the, you know, kind of the cheesy effects to make me feel like it's an epic game.
I need more explosions.
That's just my opinion.
More cowbell?
You need more explosions. More cowbell. Definitely more cowbell.
You said you wanted more explosions?
I never really played Hearthstone. I think I tried it once when it was brand new and never touched it again. So I can't really make those comparisons because I never played. And so even if it is just like Hearthstone, I don't care because I never played. I love the voiceovers. They're very professional. It sort of draws you in, although I skip over a lot of them now once I've done the quest the first time. Yeah. I wish there was almost like an auto skip. Like once you've done a quest, you don't have to sit through it. But I don't know. I think it's a lot of fun. And I think I don't know exactly how much work Caleb did. Maybe we can ask him in a couple weeks, like for the game, like how much is him and how much is the developers themselves. But he definitely seems like he did a bang-up job in terms of translating the game into an online environment. Because I think word-for-word translation would have been boring. It wouldn't have been fun, I don't think.
Well, it would have just been Octagon with automation, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And I know that there's some... I think it's a fairly small minority, but I know that there's some people still clamoring for that. But this is how you... on some level translate the game into digital. The card game that we know and love is way too complex to even, like, I mean, even looking at the way they solved attachments where you have these slots and you can only have one thing in each slot, that's such a huge improvement, right? I kind of like some of this stuff I wish they would bring to the game.
Yeah,
because it would just immediately eliminate the, like, oh, I have a character with riding two horses, wielding wielding two swords, a bow, and wearing two different suits of armor, and it's like, well, that's freaking ridiculous. Like, you get these absurdities in the card game that are eliminated before they even happen by just having these attachment slots, for example.
And I do like the pace of it as well. You see more of your deck, but it doesn't feel like you're drawing them too quickly. That was another thing, too, I noticed with the game I played today. With the Ziggle Miner and with Bilbo, like, I was rolling in resources, and I didn't have any card draw, but I still had enough cards. I actually I was able to play big cards like Raymond of War. So, I don't know. I think a lot of people... I don't know. It's day one... I had to back off the internet because the nerd rage was too strong because people were writing these scathing reviews after playing the game for like a couple hours. And so I think like we're in beta. The card pool is barely developed. It's going to develop a lot, even the course over early access. So everything I'm saying is very positive. I'm glad you guys feel good about the game too, but like all that could change at the drop of a download, at any, at any course over early access. So it'll be cool to see, cool to see how the game develops. And who knows, maybe we'll get to chat with some FFI games at Con of the Rings next month.
And it seems reasonably priced, I think is my last comment, in terms of the quest. I mean, I'd already bought everything, and then they came out with the announcement, oh, you don't have to pay for it. Well, son of a bitch, I just did. I guess I'll get some Valor points or whatever.
Right, exactly.
But I already have everything, so it's like, well, whoop-de-doo, I guess I don't get to do anything for it. The Palantir thing is even kind of fun.
I think it's fun, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think it's fun. I'm really bad at video games, and then I start them, and I love them, and I never finish. So I don't know that this will be a game that I'd be invested in the long term. However, once co-op is online and you guys force me to play, then I probably will.
That's what I was going to say, is that people need to bear that in mind. I wish there was some kind of rule for online commentary on something where you had to spend a non-trivial fraction thinking before you speak.
Yeah.
A non-trivial fraction of the amount of time the designer spent making the thing. So, like, to put that in perspective for listeners that are wondering what the heck I'm ranting about, I've made software for the last 20 years, and you can spend a year or two writing something, and to have someone spend 5 seconds with it and immediately dismiss it as garbage, maybe it's garbage and they're right, but it is very frustrating as someone who creates things for a living to have someone spend basically zero effort to try and see if the thing that you spend all this work making is actually any good or has the potential to be good down the road. So that's the one thing I would encourage people to do, is bear in mind that there's people that spent months and months and months and months making this, and they're going to continue to evolve it and smooth off the rough edges or whatever. But to sit there and honestly think that it's okay after 5 minutes to have this is my complete reaction to this thing and I'm unwavering in my opinion
and I'm right,
And I'm absolutely right, and anyone who's wrong, I'm just going to shout them down on the internet, when you literally just spent 5 minutes looking at this thing that someone could have spent the last year of their life trying to make, take a step back, have a little bit of perspective. That's all I'm saying.
For sure, man.
So I shouldn't say that Hall of Bjorn that I just found is garbage?
Well, you're allowed to say that. I mean, it's software written by a giant fucking bear. Come on, like, he can't even type.
That's true. So
he just bangs the keyboard with his massive paws.
Oh, that's a little Wookiee-ish.
Is Bilbo a hero or is he an ally in the game? He's an ally, right?
He's an ally right
he's
now.
He's not in my deck. I think.
No, you like rescue him or whatever. That's right. I don't know if the version that you rescue is going to be the hero version later, but it's pretty cool.
I feel like he died. I don't have him anymore. Or he goes away or something.
Yeah, he does. You play him in the tutorial, and then the fifth quest, you rescue him.
I'm not that far. I'm stuck.
Yeah. One other thing I will say, and then we'll get on to the book club, is Devaresh over on his Reflections in Henneth Anoon blog estimated that the cost, they're talking about doing quarterly seasons, so every 3 months they'll have a new season's worth of content, which would be a new campaign and hero packs. Wow. And he approximated that it'll be about $16 a quarter to play the new content. So if that's at all accurate, then I think the buy-in on that is nothing for... Yeah. Especially people like us coming from tabletop, where we'll drop 20,
it's
20 on a
freaking
big box.
Bargain, right?
So hopefully that is the actual price point when the rubber meets the road, and that'll be that'll be cool.
And if you play enough, you have those valor points.
That's right. All right. Anything else before we crack open a book like old timers?
I just want to say good job on Caleb, because I can see some of his influence on the theme of that of the digital. And I have I mean, we'll talk to him soon and confirm, but I feel like he's had a good influence on that game.
Yeah. And one thing that was interesting is the dude, I can't think of his name off the top of my head, he's the president of FFG, stepping down this year.
Christian Peterson.
He actually wrote the campaign, and the writing's pretty darn good. For like the, you know, the cutscenes in between the scenes and everything. So it's cool. And he
had done one of the previous campaigns for the cycles for the game.
Yeah.
Didn't he? I feel like I've heard that, but I could be wrong.
I believe so. Or he did one of the Lord of the Rings FFG games. But anyway, so yeah, there's some love and care going into the lore side as well. So hopefully they'll keep that up. All right. Well, let's begin the book club. For those of you following along at home, we do the same thing every time. We tackle three chapters or two in the case of this episode. And we're going to give a quick recap of the chapter. And then we are going to discuss the chapter itself, and then we're going to talk about how it was adapted to the game and really what we think about that. Tonight's chapters are The Last Debate and The Black Gate Opens as we finish the first part. I guess this would be book 6, right? The first part of The Return of the King. And, heck, guys, we're doing it. We might actually finish this thing.
What?
Believe it or not.
That's crazy talk.
Might actually win some money, because I'm sure some people were betting against us. All right, so let's talk about the last debate. So in this chapter, we begin with Legolas and Gimli taking a stroll around Minas Tirith, and they meet up with Merry and Pippin. The companions share their harrowing story of what happened after the Paths of the Dead. Aragorn, Gandalf, Imrahil, Amor, and the Sons of Elrond meet to discuss what is to be done next. They decide to follow Aragorn in an attack on the Black Gates of Mordor. And I'd like to kick off the discussion for this chapter with the very beginning there, which is like the very first section. Gimli and Legolas are just strolling around Minas Tirith, and they're basically like kind of throwing some shade, as we say these days, whereas Gimli is kind of critiquing the stone masonry and Legolas is saying there aren't enough gardens. But the cool thing is that they both say that, like, you know, once all this nonsense is over with, we're going to come back with some friends and we're going to, you know, clean things up and help Aragorn out. I just thought that was such a cool touch. It kind of reminded me of something you always talk about, Matthew. When we talk about like theme decks, you always talk about how like the Lord of the Rings is all about disparate people coming together, and this is kind of an example of that, where like in this new age where Aragorn is going to become king, at least for a little while, elves, men, and dwarves, and hobbits are all going to live together and contribute to the new Gondor. So I really like that idea.
It's almost like people are stronger through unity than disunity.
Nonsense. Yeah, but it also seems
MAGA
to be helping.
MAGA, make Gondor great again.
MAGA. 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 But it's also cool because, like, in this sense, like, Strider is kind of solidifying his claim, right? So he came in on the ships, you know, kind of on the wings of prophecy, as we learn, and then he comes in as a healer, And then he's also got like dwarves and elves that are going to come and help him out. So anyway, I like that part. What do you guys want to talk about?
I don't have much to say about this particular chapter. I only have two notes. One is completely trivial, but I thought it was interesting that this is one of the few times in the story where it's not third person, like bird's eye view of what's happening, but rather Legolas is discussing things firsthand. I don't know if that means anything or whatever, but it just sort of, it didn't take me out of the book, but it was just like, oh, this is different than how like everything else has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they tell it. Yeah. Okay, Dan.
I agree. It feels like these two chapters kind of feel like glued chapters where he probably had the other stuff written before. And then he's like, oh, I need to have some kind of link between, you know, these big battles that are happening. And so that there's a segue from one to the next.
Mm-hmm. But they tell a good story, Legolas and Gimli, and I especially like the part, we touched on this a little bit when we first got to the passing of the Grey Company, where Legolas and presumably the Sons of Elrond have no fear of the dead at all, whereas poor Gimli kind of admits his shame and being so afraid. But we also get an interesting, and this is one of those things that you don't really care about until you've read the book a couple times, where Legolas is describing all the little townships and things that they pass through, and how the people there were already fighting with the Haradrim and the
Umbar, the folk of Umbar.
Yeah, the Corsairs of Umbar and all that stuff. So I love those little details, especially because I don't play the Lord of the Rings online really anymore, but I did play that part where you're going from town to town helping them fight off the invaders. So it's kind of cool for me to visually kind of put those two things together, that Gondor is a civilized place, and there are these big towns that we learn have thousands of soldiers. And at this point in the story, the soldiers are actually marching northwards now that the company or the dead have taken care of the invaders. So to me, it was kind of like the edges of the map in my headcanon were getting penciled in a little bit. And we also hear a lot about this dude, Angbor, who I didn't bother to look up, but I did look up the fact that we don't have a card of him yet, so I wonder if that could be a potential future Outlands guy if we decide to tinker with Outlands at all anymore.
Yeah, it's terrifying to think how powerful that archetype would be if they added another Outlands hero.
Yeah.
But, I did have the same thought. There's one, it's actually kind of interspersed with your note right off the bat about Legolas and Gimli kind of, you know, subtly dissing Gondor, but at the same time showing a kind of a deeper respect for it, is there's an interesting little bit of poetry as they're describing kind of men and the works of men as opposed to the other races.
Yeah, that's a great bit.
That I really liked. I'll just read it really briefly. It's, well, first of all, they're talking about Imrahil, and I really like this. If Gondor, I think this is Legolas, if Gondor has such men still in these days of fading, great must have been its glory in the days of its rising. So it's a real deep compliment to Prince Imrahil. And then Gimli is talking about, you know, and doubtless good stonework is the older and was wrought in the first building, said Gimli. It is ever so with the things that men begin. There is a frost in spring or a blight in summer, and they fail of their promise,
mm-hmm.
which is, it really fits the theme in these last few chapters where you just keep reiterating the waning of Gondor and how it was this great thing, but it never really fully fulfilled its promise. And I mean, the fact that it was the stewards taking over because the line of kings kind of died out is a really obvious evidence of that argument.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
Hmm. It's very historical too. I like that. Gondor always gets compared to the Roman Empire, but I like, you know, when you study the Byzantine Empire, the Roman Empire, any great empire, there's always this ebb and flow depending on who the ruler is. And so even though we know Gondor is falling away from its high beginnings, it kind of is getting a shot in the arm with the return of the king. And so they're kind of back on the upswing. And we know a little bit about the Fourth Age, about Aragorn and Eomer going eastwards and things like that. But it is nice that even though Gondor is falling, they're going to at least get one more, or, you know, a few more, depending on how well Aragorn's progeny do, a few more generations of good times before all the magic is gone.
The only other thing that I thought was interesting in the chapter was how Tolkien sort of describes the forces of Mordor in that, you know, we've talked about this many times in the book club, but how Tolkien is often accused of one-dimensional characters, particularly on the part of the bad guys. But in this case, through Legolas's story, what he's describing is how not only was Gimli scared, as you brought up, but the enemy was scared too. They were scared of the dead.
That's a great line.
They weren't overcome by, you know, Legolas shooting someone right between the eyes. Beep, beep, beep. They weren't overcome with fancy flanking or anything like that. It was just the pure terror that the army of the dead had on the Dark Lord's forces. And so I thought that was interesting. And so it made it where, you know, the good guys are probably scared of this stuff, but the bad guys are scared of it too. And it really just is sort of this battle between, maybe I'm stretching here or reaching here, but, you know, two imperfect mortal cultures, so to speak, where they each have their idea of how to do things, but they're both scared of this one thing. And sort of related to that, I thought Gandalf here mentions how Sauron just couldn't conceive of someone not trying to take the ring for selfish and aggressive reasons. And so that's why he's so blind to what's happening, because he can't picture selflessness or sacrifice, and that someone would want to destroy the ring willingly as opposed to having its power. So, I mean, that's sort of back to one-dimensional bad guy, but I thought the terror thing was sort of interesting and made me wonder, like, I wonder why he put this in here.
I completely agree with the culture clash thing you're talking about, and I think it ties into what you were saying about how, you know, Sauron couldn't conceive of someone giving away the ring. In the same way, Legolas says, "In that hour, I looked at Aragorn. I thought how great and terrible a lord he might have become in the strength of his will, had he taken the ring to himself. Because not only does he command the dead, there's a line where it talks about how like Gimli was only dragged along through the paths of the dead by the will of Aragorn. And so, getting back to the culture thing, on the one hand, you have a culture that understands how dangerous the dark side, sorry to mix metaphor, mix references here, but the darkness is versus cultures that have largely embraced it. You can't say totally embraced it, you know, because we have that line from Sam, and the Herodrim cycle explored that idea of good Southrons as well. But the society that largely embraced the darkness, and then, as you said, Matthew, it was either Gimli or Legolas. "Strange and wonderful, I thought it, that the designs of Mordor should be overthrown by such wraiths of fear and darkness. With its own weapons was it worsted." So the culture that maintained its position standing against evil things rather than succumbing to the temptation of power was able to, at least through the person of Aragorn, better or best the other side, which had such a fixation with darkness. So I think you're onto something there, and it's pretty interesting to look at the little tidbits we have of these cultures of Middle Earth and weigh them against each other.
Yeah, I had, I don't know what I was reading. I was reading some article recently, and this is, to me, ties more into the next chapter than this one, but it fits in either place, where it was about C.S. Lewis and some of the things that he had to say about Lord of the Rings. And he sort of said that both the good and the evil characters in Lord of the Rings involve imagination and logic. And C.S. Lewis was saying that the evil guys, the bad guys, can't imagine themselves doing anything else but evil. So for them, evil is the only logical course of action. It's necessary. It's sort of just their instinct, so to speak. But the good guys in Lord of the Rings, C.S. Lewis says, can conceive of doing evil, but they choose to do good. And so for them, life is a bunch of free choices. Very sort of Christian, I think, here, which makes sense coming from both of these dudes. But basically, he was saying that the good have the power to choose to take actions that are unexpected, and Sauron can't even fathom that. And again, this is where it begins to tie to the next chapter, but Sauron expects a challenge from Aragorn with the ring, and because greed backed by, I guess, violent, aggressive confrontation is all that Sauron can understand, but he can't imagine that the armies of the West are actually a diversion. They're a distraction. And so I just thought it was really interesting that's how C.S. Lewis saw good and evil in Lord of the Rings. But it's probably very much how he viewed good and evil of heaven versus hell or something. I don't know. But I don't know. I just thought it was really interesting, and I wish I could find that article because it was cool. But I jotted it down because I actually read that before I read this. I was like, oh, that totally is what he was talking about.
That's so cool. If you find that, send it to me. I'll put it in the show notes because I'd like to read it myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, what you're talking about is really important, though, I think, for people to understand in the broader context of this narrative. Is I've heard a fair number of people talk about the plot of the Lord of the Rings books is not making sense in the big picture. Is like, how is Sauron is so stupid, or how does he not see what's going on? And the answer to that is fundamental to his character, right? His mind only works one way. And even when you hear the descriptions of how his underlings operate, and you see it reflected in, like, the lieutenant, you know, or aka the mouth of Sauron, you see it in the way that he corrupted Saruman, and you see it over and over and over again, that he's all about control and perverting things and, you know, influence, using his power over others that are less powerful from him, right? And so he projects that onto everything else. And so his biggest fear, and this is why what Aragorn did with the Palantir is so important in the overall plot, his biggest fear is someone else that is capable of wielding the power that is held in the ring, taking it and fighting against him. Mm-hmm. So that's all he can see. He's myopic to any other alternative, which is exactly why Gandalf's gamble is such a brilliant one, is it's the one weak spot that he has. Is he can't conceive of people willingly giving the ring up and destroying it.
Right. Well, anything else in this chapter before we talk about cards?
The one other thing I wanted to bring up, because I really thought it was an interesting bit. Legolas actually has a lot of good stuff in this chapter, but he mentions kind of offhand that, like, when they were doing the battle where the army of the dead, the host of the dead, basically helped them win this battle, the precursor to them getting to Pelennor, he kind of looks at Aragorn at one point and says, "Wow, I'm so glad you didn't choose to take the ring," because it's this, like, what if kind of moment of, if Aragorn had taken the ring, he would have been a terrible lord. And that's, it ties back into what I was just talking about, where, like, that's exactly what Sauron fears. Sauron fears Aragorn having the ring and then using it.
Yeah. Pretty kicking fan fiction.
Yeah. So, yeah, someone should write that alternate history where Aragorn goes bad, dark paladin.
You were the chosen one.
Oh, no. Don't put that mental image. Why would you do that to me, Derek?
Sorry. Okay, let's talk cards.
Those damn midichlorians.
That's what's in the ring.
Sigh.
All right, let's talk cards. Let's see. Again, this kind of meshes with the Passing of the Grey Company, because the Passing of the Grey Company quest gets into what Legolas just describes about them getting the dead, going to the Stone of Erech, flying through Gondor, and then heading down to Pelargir for the big fight. So, a little bit of overlap there, but what do you guys think about the... I was almost about to say we could talk about the Stone of Erech quest, but I'm not going to do that to you guys. So what do we think about kind of the adaptation of that particular quest? Because it seems like, I don't know, like, it's cool in that... I guess I'll just answer my own question since I'm on it. But it's cool that, like, we go through that whole journey, but it seems to be... I don't know, as much about the battle at Pelargir as it is about the dead. That's a tricky one to balance, right? Because there's so much going on within the scope of these events, because they're just rapidly going through Mordor, or through Gondor. So I guess I haven't quite made up my mind as to how well they struck the balance between emphasizing certain parts of this particular story.
I feel like they have the same challenge that... Peter Jackson had in adapting these books to a movie, is that you want to hit the big notes, you know, the big battles, but really some of the stuff that makes Aragorn such a cool character to me is some of these other things that happen kind of in between the battles, or the fact that he would have the guts to even do the Paths of the Dead to begin with is pretty cool. And they keep, like, there's echoes back to that where they keep mentioning, like, Gimli won't even talk about that part of it. He's like, I don't want to talk about it. But so there's other things there that I think are more subtle and nuanced about his character, but really the quest, just like the movie, have to kind of just go to the battles, right, and give you the big dramatic moments.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and I don't like, there's not really a way to make a game out of it, but I didn't like the fact that you're fighting so many of these, of the Oathbreakers. The fear thing is pretty cool, the way it plays with your threat dial. But I don't know. It's a fun quest. I have a very strong memory of the first time I played it with Chad back, doggone, like 2 years ago at Gen Con. It was good times. And then when you actually get to fighting the Corsairs at Peller Gear, it's, I don't know, kind of basic pirate action, but it's good times.
Basic pirate action.
Hey, I just saw a Dragon Con parade where pirates were driving around the streets of Atlanta, so I think I know a thing or two about piracy.
I had a punk band in middle school called Basic Pirate Action. It was short lived.
Get out of here.
Yeah. We had one really big hit back in the late 80s called Glug Glug Glug.
No, I want to listen to some Ailstorm. Okay. look them up, friends. But anyway, so I guess getting back on track somehow. Speaking of pirates, there's our segue. Is this where we lump in all the Peller Gear people? Because this is, you know, we don't actually go to Peller Gear, save in memory. But then we have like Peller Gear.
The shipwrights, the envoys, the
captains.
What's the other Peller
Gear? Isn't there a captain?
Captains, oh my.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is a captain.
Ship, I'm a boat captain.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, this is one of those things. Maybe, I don't know, Matthew, maybe you have something brilliant to throw in here, but it's kind of like you needed things that go with ships. You got a random spot on a map, so let's make them from Peller Gear. Is that fair assessment?
Sure.
Boats.
All right. I like to the sea. I will throw that out there.
Yeah.
I think it's a theme win. It fits the mechanics of Noldor, but it also has some of the kind of poetry of the book. So I think it works.
Yeah, let's talk about that one for a minute. So those of you who forgot, like me, you attach a Noldor character action Exhaust to the sea and discard X cards from your hand to reduce the cost of the next Noldor ally played this phase by X. How do you shoehorn that in with the lore there? Because the reference is that Legolas is longing for the sea. You know, he'd never been to the sea before, and now he's heard the gulls, and now he's like itching to take a boat.
I didn't appreciate how genius the Noldor design was until thinking about it with these chapters kind of helped me put it into context. Is there's something like wistful and nostalgic about elves' relationship to the sea, because mm-hmm. they all realize, like, that's where I ultimately have to go. I don't belong here. They're kind of strangers in Middle Earth. So the whole discarding cards is kind of this cool, to me, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but it kind of feels like, you know, you're losing something to gain something. There's something kind of cool going on there.
I can see that. Yeah, like
nostalgia.
Yeah, power at a cost kind of thing. I can see that. That's cool. All right. Let's go to that Black Gate, shall we?
Yep.
All right. So the next chapter is The Black Gate Opens. And here in the 10th chapter of this book, the host assembles to ride for Mordor, blasting their trumpets as they go. They leave Gondor, about 7,000 strong men of Gondor and Rohan together. I think sidebar here for those who like to count things, it's about 6,000 foot soldiers, about 1,000 cavalry. They reach the crossroads and the king's head is replaced. And they decide to avoid Minas Morgul after destroying its bridge, and then they head straight for the Black Gate. They are waylaid along the way and harassed by the Nazgul, and some of their soldiers are so overcome by fear that Aragorn sends them to defend Cair Andros, and they hopefully win back their honor. At the gate, the mouth of Sauron appears, and after some banter, returns inside. Immediately, a host of enemies pour out of the gate, and battle commences. There's a lot of crossover. I'm reading, as I've said several times, I'm reading this with my daughter, and so reading it out loud, I'm picking up on things. And so with this book in particular, by that I mean book 6, there's a lot of Tolkien pointing out, like, who's where and when.
Book
so
5. It's like, jeez, get it right.
Is it book 5? 1,
yes,
2.
There's
yeah,
only
yeah,
6
yeah, yeah.
total. 3 divided
no, you're
by
right,
2.
You're right.
Don't
my
you
bad.
Teach.
Forgive me, for love
Simple
of God.
Simple math.
The Pippin, you know, it's like Pippin is looking out over Ithilien on the same time that Frodo did. And so it's cool that we get that crossover as well here, where the soldiers of Gondor repair the statue at the crossroads, which, you know, mm-hmm. Frodo and Sam had that cool moment there. But we were ranting about cards there for a minute. Matthew, what do you want to talk about in this chapter?
I have more to say on this chapter, I think. Not much
Let's
more, but a little bit more. But one just is dovetailing with my last comment. And there's this chapter to me is just full of irony, and one of the there's a few ironic moments to me, but one of them is the characters themselves note, which is how Aragorn defeated Mordor with the dead, but they themselves once were sort of minions of Sauron. And so I thought that was sort of interesting.
The Oathbreakers?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So that's just sort of interesting how, again, Tolkien's playing with good or evil. But basically, I thought that this march to Mordor was ironic in a couple of ways. One is that this opposing army, or whatever you want to call them, is approaching enemy territory shouting and singing their claim over the land, which I thought was sort of interesting. But the second thing I thought was interesting is that, or ironic really, is that Sauron thinks that he's super smart and super manipulative and he's getting Aragorn to bring his forces in, but it's actually the other way around, which goes to my C.S. Lewis comment, which is that, you know, good choose what they're doing. And so Sauron can't imagine being any other way, so he sort of thinks that I've outwitted Aragorn, but rather Aragorn's forces choose to do this. They want to play into his hands to keep him distracted away from Frodo. And so I thought that both of those were just sort of interesting ironies, I suppose. But the most interesting one is when Gandalf confronts the lieutenant. But I'll save that comment for a bit. Hear what you guys think.
Yeah. Dan?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think there's it's interesting to see he's kind of taking some of the narrative touches that he's given you up to this point and plays them back in reverse. Like, I mean, everything from he makes a point of having Frodo and Sam notice the toppled head and the orc head put on top of the statue of, you know, one of the ancient kings of Gondor, and they go and repair it and try and, you know, they would actually spend time. I mean, here they're going to go to the climactic battle to end all battles, and Aragorn or somebody in charge says, yeah, we're going to actually spend the hour to stay here and clean up the graffiti, essentially. That's interesting, right? Like, why would you do that when you're going to this big important battle? And it's some of these things are kind of symbolic, I think, of something deeper. But I'm definitely with Matthew. There's some deep irony going on here in these chapters.
Yeah, it almost feels like, you know, they are trying to goad Sauron. It's as much mental warfare and tactics as it is anything else, as is made obvious in several lines in here. But I like that they are trying to do some mental warfare or psychological warfare against Sauron, where they're blasting the trumpets, you know, declaring their intentions, as Matthew mentioned. And then Imrahil says, well, don't say Gondor, say the King Elisar.
Yeah, they're trolling Sauron specifically.
Yeah.
It's really effective. I mean, I really think if you go back to the everything kind of stems from when Aragorn took the Palantir as his rightful heirloom and said, you know what, I'm going to use this as a weapon. And it's cool that he's using Sauron's greatest weapon against him, right? He's using fear. He's basically making the bluff that he has the ring and he's willing to use it is ultimately what's happening here.
But then the bluffing continues when the mouth of Sauron appears. And quick aside, in the movies, I absolutely love the makeup and the voice for the mouth of Sauron. But I was reminded this time that Aragorn locks eyes with him and the mouth doesn't react well. So then I thought, wait a second, in the movies and in a lot of the art, how could they have locked eyes with him when he, like, doesn't have eyes? But anyway, he then pulls out the mithril shirt and the sword and what else did he have?
The sword.
Yeah, all that stuff. And so then it's like...
The cloak with
the cloak,
brooch.
Yeah, with the brooch. And so it's just like, you know, it's as much, again, psychological warfare or rhetoric as it is anything else. It's such a cool exchange, and I love what a snarky SOB the mouth of Sauron is. He's like, does anyone here have the wit to even talk to me? You know, it's so good.
I remember when I read it the one and only time in my life as a kid, not counting obviously this read through, but I was always disappointed that Gandalf didn't use his magic enough. And he's like, how is this a wizard when he like never does anything magic-y? And I still think I feel that way to a large degree as an adult. But I will say in this part where he's confronting the lieutenant that, you know, Gandalf's words here are entirely consistent, even though I might not like it, with his approach to confronting the bad guys throughout the entire book. So I was sort of having flashbacks to the Balrog in Moria, and there's, I think, parallels there to what he does here, because he doesn't use any magic, again, much to my chagrin. He uses his words, and so he confronts the enemy with speech, and he just yells, "Begone," and that's, like, all he does. But this word, I think, goes back to what the C.S. Lewis thing, and maybe I'm reading way too much into C.S. Lewis talking about his friend Tolkien, but I was thinking, this again, Gandalf yelling, "Begone," is the choice to choose between doing evil or relenting and coming to the side of good. And to me, I was like, maybe Gandalf is implying here that good and evil aren't two sides. What's the word I want? They're not diametrically opposed. But instead, again, it comes down to a choice that individuals have to make. Good and evil are in the mind, and they're in your actions. And it's not just some natural inclination. I don't know. Maybe I'm reaching in that, reading that little letter that whatever's Bucket wrote colored my entire reading of these two chapters. But it's just interesting that Gandalf, as a wizard, never really does wizardy things.
Yeah, it's the later adaptations that don't really understand or don't maybe appreciate the deeper things that Tolkien's trying to do that I think make fantasy seem more like an RPG script or something. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're reading in too much at all, because I think C.S. Lewis was tremendously influential on Tolkien and had as good a read on what Tolkien was trying to do as anybody. So I'm right there with you, Matthew, on your take on these chapters.
I think the issue, if we want to talk about good and evil and shades of gray, is that, I think the idea of choice is present within the world that it's in these books. The thing is that we see people who have already chosen one side or the other. Do you know what I mean? So Sauron and... Mm-hmm. Probably all the orcs, most of the orcs, the Balrog, the Mouth of Sauron, have all chosen evil, even though they don't see it themselves that way. Mm-hmm. Gandalf, Aragorn, Elrond, Faramir, all these guys have already chosen good, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So we don't see a lot of characters who are kind of in that gray area where they're still deciding for themselves.
Boromir is probably the closest.
Exactly. That's what I was about to say. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, you're right.
And Gollum too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very intensified in the character of Gollum. Because he's almost like everybody else is in the shades of gray, he's like jumping from white to black. And back and forth.
Oscillating constantly between two extremes, right?
It's crazy. And even Frodo and Sam is probably, Sam is fully in the good, but he has those moments of doubt, which we saw at the end of the Two Towers. And then Frodo, under the influence of the ring, is kind of oscillating as well. So it's there. It's just we just see characters who are already at either pole, which makes it seem a little bit more black and white.
Yeah. And again, I could be reading way too much into the word begone, which is like, well, you're clearly giving this dude a choice to walk away when he outnumbers you like 10-1 or whatever it is. Whereas you could have approached it an entirely different way. And sometimes I wonder how much authors really consider all of these things, or if they just write and it kind of comes out. And I don't know how deeply they think about things. But, and I'm sure different authors think differently about other things. But it just sort of made me think that in a way that's Gandalf giving this dude a choice. And in a way, Gandalf was giving the Balrog sort of a choice. Like, I'm not going to be super wizardy here and, do whatever his people do. But rather, I'm going to talk at you.
Which speaks to what it means to be good in Middle-earth, which is not dominating anyone. So if we're taking your theory a step further, then it's like Gandalf kind of being that pure white, in this case literally, because he's Gandalf the White, that pure white, holy good, whatever. Is he actually offering a choice to something that's pure evil when he could have just chopped his head off like Aragorn did in the movie,
Right.
Oh gosh, of all the things in the movie, this is where we really have to make like a wall between what's in the movie and what's in the book, because that was a moment where I'm just like, what am I watching? the book is very, I agree with you guys about good and evil. I want to add though that it's also very much about power, and these two things are interrelated, because I want to say it's a Faramir quote, but it's totally relevant to what we're talking about, this idea of like not worshipping the sword for its sharpness or not worshipping the warrior for his valor, that like these things exist for a reason, and you don't mistake the means for the underlying reason for things, right? So that it's like that. I think it's precisely related to why, you know, in Matthew's point about Gandalf not doing a lot of wizardy things, is Gandalf, there are moments when he clearly has the ability to do that. It's not that he just is like faking it the whole time and doesn't actually have power. There's moments when he chooses to show power, but very often he doesn't. And I feel like his withholding that use of power is a sign of wisdom and that he does truly have power, that he's not constantly, you know, kind of showing it off, so to speak.
Yep.
And I really, really like the it's funny you mentioned the movie where they weren't able to make eye contact because the mouth of Sauron doesn't really have eyes, but I love in the book that it's another sign of power that Aragorn basically just stares the mouth of Sauron down, and here he is with 7,000 guys, which is such a pittance, right? Like, if you can imagine the context is you have this tiny army and you're arrayed against overwhelming forces, and he's staring the guy down and makes the guy look away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of incredible, right? Like, to like, he has so much power within him, so much courage, that he's able to make the emissary of the enemy look away and feel fear in that situation, which is kind of crazy.
Which seems to go back to what Gandalf said about in the previous chapter, how Emrahil was talking about how silly it was that they were all doing this with so few people, and then Gandalf said something like, you know, there are names among us that are worth 1,000 soldiers. So that's, that's probably what he meant. All right, anything else before we talk cards?
Let me check my
notes. It's hard to believe that this part is done. To Frodo.
There's one other thing. We mentioned it in the discussion notes. I just want to go over it briefly here, though. It's another sign of Aragorn really being a great leader is when they get to the gate, there's some that came with them all the way from, I want to say, like Lamadon or the Outland somewhere, that they had only ever heard of Mordor in, like, fairy tales, basically. And so they thought of it as this, oh, you say that to, like, scare your children to you know, do their chores or something. And they get there, and they're terrified. And rather than have them just feel shame and fear and run away, Aragorn basically gives them an out and says, go, said Aragorn, but keep what honor you may, and do not run. And there is a task which you may attempt, and so not be wholly shamed. Take your way south until you come to Cair Andros, and if that is still held by enemies, as I think, then retake it if you can, and hold it to the last defense of Gondor and Rohan. So that's amazing leadership right there. Rather than like shame them or try and like cajole them into like being part of a battle they don't want to be part of, he basically gives them an option of something else to do that they're capable of, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is really cool.
I agree.
Traitors. Deserters.
Deserters.
Where's Ice? We need to chop their heads off.
All right, let's talk cards.
Matthew knows exactly how to trigger me.
Yeah, I mean, he's throwing out political stuff. I'm throwing out movie references, man. I'm sorry we're trolling you so hard.
Oh, I meant Ice as in Ned Stark's sword. My bad.
Oh.
Yeah, that's what you meant.
No, it really was. He chops off the head the first episode.
That's right, yeah.
The Deserter. Come on now. Learn your nerd references.
Well, it's a different podcast. Okay. So the way this is worked into the game is the second quest of the Mountain of Fire, which is the Black Gate opens. And I think it's the second quest. Yeah, it's the second quest. Anyway, so it's this exactly the scene. You have the start with the embassy. There's the Mouth of Sauron. He's there. He's in the staging area just annoying you every time you cancel an effect. And then the battle actually starts. No, to be perfectly honest, I don't think I've ever played that one. I played the Tower of Cirith Ungol, but I didn't play this particular scene, so I might have to rely on you, Dan, for a quick assessment.
I have not played it either.
I think we're going to have a playthrough. We're going to have to Twitch this.
Yeah. I think we will have to. Yeah. I mean, I'm in my saga, and I haven't actually gotten to it yet. So it's one of the like three quests in the game I've never played.
Mm. Okay.
There's a lot I haven't played.
Sounds like a Twitch event.
Mm.
So let's move on to Justice Shall Be Done, which is a great... I mean, there's so many great lines in this, but then the heralds go forth to call out Sauron, and they say, let justice shall be done upon him, for wrongfully he has made war upon Gondor and wrested its lands, so on and so forth. So I don't know. I'm pretty sure you pasted this one, Dan, so I feel like you mentioned it kind of already, so why don't you take it away here? Talk about what a thematic grand slam this is.
There's moments that I have where I really have deep respect for the designers of the game, of like reading the text, kind of doing what we're doing, and then having a deep insight into just how epic some of the stuff is, and to where it's why I have voice frustration with other authors that don't maybe understand some of these concepts, or other games, other adaptations of the source material or the movies for that matter, that kind of miss the point. Is Justice Shall Be Done is one of the greatest cards in this game in terms of theme. It's I should pull it up just because it's probably a card a lot of people don't use, since it's it makes you lose the game at the end of the round. So it's kind of one of those, it's usually only for, I guess, janky decks. But I'll read the card and then I'll explain briefly why I think it's so freaking epic. So limit one per deck. It's a sign right there. It's pretty powerful. Planning action. Add Justice Shall Be Done to the victory display to draw three cards. Add three resources to the resource pool of each hero you control. At the end of the round, you're eliminated from the game. I thought it was kind of a fun, like, combo-y card when it was released. And then reading this chapter and reading the line, oh, and Justice Shall Be Done, it's just kind of, it's almost a throwaway line in the chapter. But then it made me think back to this card and realize, holy crap, this card is amazing, right? You get all this stuff, you basically go all in, and at the end of the round, you die. And that's exactly what this battle is, right? Mm-hmm. The battle at the gate is them basically saying, well, we don't know whether Frodo's going to make it or not. We don't know. Maybe Sauron's already got the ring. Maybe we've already lost. Who knows? But you know what? We're going to go all in, and we'll see what happens. And it makes this card just absolutely amazing to me.
And the flavor text is the quote we read at the beginning of the show, which is like the most meta, probably the most meta line of the game. It is Aragorn speaking. It is the last move in a great jeopardy, and for one side or the other, it will bring the end of the game.
Yep. Yeah, you couldn't get much more on the nose than that quote right there.
Yeah, it's perfect. Well, we spent some time talking about the Mouth of Sauron, and in the quest that I mentioned that apparently we're gonna have to play later, the Mouth of Sauron is there with 99 threat engagement, which is hilarious, just because... But he has the force effect. He just hangs out in the staging area, cannot leave staging area. His force effect is after a player cancels a when revealed effect, the Mouth of Sauron makes an immediate attack against that player. And I've been trying to think of how you can, you know, argue your way into the lore for this one. I'm sure Caleb could explain it, but I don't really see the tie-in, which is fine. You know, it's a cool card. It does what it's supposed to do during the quest, I assume. But I just don't see how that... I don't know. I guess that's kind of like him... hanging back, calling the shots, since he is the mouth and the spokesperson, maybe. I don't know. Doesn't matter. But it's a cool card. All right. Any other cards we should talk about?
I can't believe you thought I was talking about the acronym ICE. Jeez. Ruined a good joke.
I don't know. I mean, sometimes you're edgy with
never...
your humor.
There's no, just... I don't have edgy humor. I have funny humor.
Okay.
It just can be funny.
I even like had to Google. I was like, "Oh crap! Is it not named Ice? Did I f*** that one up?" No, it's named Ice.
That's a really unfortunate name for that sword, because it's really hard for me to hear that word right now.
About other things. Tell Ned Stark to change it. Except he's dead. Spoiler alert.
That's like the last nerd on the planet, just going, "No, he dies." Forget this podcast.
Yeah, for anyone for whom we spoiled
really
Game
anything.
Of Thrones, I don't know what to tell you, man. Like, at this point, I think maybe you're a little late on the
yeah.
I already had it. I had Infinity War spoiled for me at the DragonCon parade yesterday, but that's a long story, and we're wrapping things up here in a minute. I haven't seen Infinity War. Okay, I'm not a part of the culture.
I haven't either, because I've basically given up on comic book movies, so don't.
They're all the same to me. I don't feel like they're different enough. So,
but then like Infinity War was such an event that I feel like I have to see it.
Yeah.
So I'll just probably.
I do sort of want to see Black Panther because everyone raved about it, but I'm like, it's probably going to feel like all the others. But I don't
know. It's gonna be the same. It's just gonna be
veneer. Black Panther is actually, I think, legitimately worth seeing, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
Cool. But people said the same thing about Wonder Woman. And it was a good movie, but it was just a superhero origin story.
Yeah.
So you're saying, Black, what are we talking about? Why, let's end the podcast. Why are we talking about Marvel?
Come on. Started talking about Infinity Wars.
I don't know That's what book fair. We're on. I'm talking about Marvel. We just need to stop.
The passing of the Great Company.
Oh,
Derek passes into madness.
Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. That hits a little too close to home there, Matthew. You just drop in every three episodes to make us all feel a little bit worse about ourselves. Well done, sir. Well done.
It's what I'm paid to do. Speaking of getting paid, someone's
paying you?
This has been... Speaking of getting paid, give us money on Patreon. Okay, this has been episode 64 of the Great Company Podcast, possibly the last.
I'm not even drunk on this episode. Stone cold sober, which is unusual.
Can we have
to put the bottle down because you're on fire tonight.
Episode 64, Matthew is sober.
Yeah, dude, put the bottle down. You're doing great. I'm not editing this out at all, by the way.
Oh, geez. Sorry, all right. Close this out.
No, please don't. That's half the humor in this episode is this stuff.
Okay, this has been episode 64 of the Great Company Podcast, brought to you by you, our patrons. If you'd like to help us with hosting fees and so on and so forth, please get to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. Extra special thanks to Chris G, the latest to join our Hobbitry in Arms. As always, you can get in touch with us through our website at greatcompanypodcast.com. From there, you can connect with us on Twitter, Facebook, Twitch, and so forth. Apparently, we're going to be doing some some campaign twitching soon, and who knows what else. I can't keep it together. We got to end this. Please send your emails to thegreatcompanypodcast@gmail.com. We would love to read your questions and comments on the air. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, farewell.
Night.